there. So as I said, this talk is in some sense a follow-up both on Daniel's talk from the last session and John Watrous's talk on Monday. And what I'd like to explain is how the ideas from those papers can be used to give protocols for two-party secure quantum computing of arbitrary functionalities. So what I'll start by doing is explaining what I mean by that. I'll sort of outline what I mean by two-party computing or secure circuit evaluation. I'll give a protocol which is essentially a reduction from the quantum problem to the problem of securely evaluating classical circuits in a way that is secure against quantum adversaries. And then finally, I'll try to explain where the hitches are in designing classical protocols for quantum adversaries, and specifically I'll focus on proofs of knowledge, and I'll hopefully I'll wind up with some open problems and some perspective at the end. Okay, so what's the two-party computing problem? You've heard it, you know, a couple of times today already, but we'll go through it anyway. We've got Alice and Bob. And let's say Alice has some input rho A, Bob has an input, a quantum state rho B, and they want to engage in some protocol, so this is exchanging quantum messages, and at the end, you know, Alice will take home one piece of information, Bob will take home another piece of information, and roughly what we'd like is we'd like that their joint state at the end results from the application of some quantum circuit U to their joint state at the beginning. And for the purposes of this talk, we may as well assume that U is just a unitary operation. It's not really important. Basically without loss of generality. Okay, so what do we want? What we want from this protocol is that, moreover, in addition to the fact that Alice and Bob get the correct output, if they're honest, we want the fact that if they're dishonest, bad things don't happen. So on one hand, we would like that neither party learns more than they should. Basically, neither party learns more than their correct output. And secondly, neither party affects the outcome except by, first of all, by virtue of their choice, the choice of input. And possibly by, they can abort the protocol in the middle. Okay, so one thing that we can't really stop Bob from doing is just walking away in the middle of the protocol. And, you know, we're not going to be able to do much about that. So informally, what this means is that we'd like this situation to be sort of somehow equivalent to a situation which looks more like this. Alice and Bob share some box which performs U, some box they can't really tamper with. All Alice gets to do is choose row A, Bob gets to choose row B. These states can be possibly entangled, that's not a problem. And then you get some joint output, row prime AB, which is the application of U to the inputs, and then, you know, one wire goes to Alice and one wire goes to Bob. So this is kind of what we want to capture. And there's a framework more or less inherited from quantum cryptography, that's what I was looking for, where for sort of phrasing this. So actually what we'll say is that we'll compare two worlds. So let's assume that Bob is the dishonest party in this particular exchange. So we'll compare two worlds. So we'll compare one world in which Bob interacts, I'll move him over a little, one world in which Bob interacts with this kind of ideal structure, And another world in which Bob and Alice interact in a real protocol. So I guess it's already over there. Okay, so let's call this the real world. And we've got some ideal world where Bob interacts with this ideal protocol, and the statement is something along the following lines. For every Bob, for every kind of circuit that Bob, strategy could that Bob can try, and we'll specify that by a polynomial-sized quantum circuit. For every kind of strategy Bob can try to implement, there exists some simulator, some Bob Prime, if you will, which also is a small quantum circuit, or a reasonably small quantum circuit, such that for all auxiliary information that Bob could get to help him out at the beginning, so we give Bob maybe some auxiliary information. I'll explain what role that plays in a minute. What we'd like is that the real world, so this is the simulator who now plays in the real world, in the ideal world, sorry. The real world should be indistinguishable from the ideal world by polynomial time quantum circuits. Okay. So to try to explain what I mean exactly, in the real world, for every input of Alice and for every essentially input of Bob, there's some output of this protocol. So we look at, on one hand, Alice's output, and on the other hand, not only Bob's output, what he's supposed to output from the protocol, because Bob may not be following the protocol. So instead, we look at everything, but basically Bob's state, Bob's complete state at the end of this protocol. Okay? And in this experiment, the simulator outputs something at the end, which is supposed to look believably like Bob's state. Okay? So it might include, you know, the transcript of all the classical messages that were sent, you know, any measurements Bob did, everything he manages to keep around, without loss of generality, he'll keep in his state. So this is what we'd like to build, and what I'd like to try and sort of convince you of is that this is achievable essentially for any U under suitable assumptions. So the main claim of the talk is that there, for any U, there exists, which is a polynomial-sized quantum circuit. For any U, there exists a protocol which is secure in the sense I just defined, assuming, well, let's just call them appropriate assumptions. Okay, so this is certainly a vaguely enough stated claim to be true, but I'll even add an asterisk that I haven't checked all the details, but I'm pretty sure it's true. I mean, obviously, I can manipulate this sentence arbitrarily, but. I think one statement that can be made is under the existence of trapdoor permutations secure against quantum adversaries. Okay. So under the existence of trapdoor one-way permutations, which are secure against quantum adversaries, the problem with this claim is that we don't have any candidates for such permutations. So classically, the natural candidates are things like RSA or squaring mod n and with certain composite n. We don't we don't know of any things that quite fit the bill, but I'm I so the meta claim is that this, you know, that we'll be able to find somebody somewhere, maybe not me, will be able to find believable assumptions under which this claim holds, and I'll try to indicate what those might be. I should mention, it's not that there's any reason to think that such permutations don't exist. We just, you know, we don't know how to build them based on sort of lattice-type assumptions, and it's pretty much the only thing we have going and at the moment that we know to be, what we think to be secure against quantum adversaries. Okay, so this is sort of the thrust of the talk. So as I said, this is the kind of the main claim. I compliment this by saying that this statement is the classical version of this statement was proven in the 80s by Goldreich, Mikali, and Vigdorsson, and independently and like 6 or 7 years earlier by Yao, but not really proven. Anyway, there's some weird confusion over this, but let's say, you know, the ideas were around in the 80s. And so the question, so what I'd like to kind of suggest is that a possible approach following what Daniel was saying in the last talk is to reduce the problem of securely computing quantum, evaluating quantum circuits to the problem of securely evaluating classical circuits. So that's the first thing I'll explain, and then I'll try to explain what hitches there are, as I said, in kind of coming up, making the standard classical protocols secure even against a quantum adversary. So these are problems along the lines of what John Watrous is wrestling with in his talk on zero knowledge. Okay, so what we need are some pieces of our protocol. So like, how do we want to build a protocol? Let's assume we're given U as a sequence of gates. And I'm just given a description of this circuit U. And now, the basic outline is going to be very similar to what is commonly the case in these types of even classical protocols. So the first thing we'll ask players to do is to somehow commit to their inputs. I'll explain what that means in a second, and maybe and share their inputs. Okay. Secondly, we need to look at how one can compute on the committed data. And finally, how one can distribute the outputs to the players. So classically, what is a bit commitment protocol? Probably most of you know this, but just in case. So classically, a protocol, a bit commitment protocol, let's say from Alice to Bob, is a two-phase protocol in which Alice sends a commitment to some value A using some random coins R. So Alice gets A as input, let's say. She picks R at random from she flips a bunch of coins and, you know, gets R as just a bunch of random bits. She uses R as her randomness in computing this commitment. She sends it to Bob. And at some later time, she'll send A and R to Bob. She'll open the commitment. So the properties are of this type of protocol is, on the one hand, based only on the commitment, Bob should not be able to learn the value of A, to learn anything about it whatsoever. But on the other hand, Alice shouldn't be able to reveal anything except the correct value of A. Okay, so what I'll actually require for the purposes of this talk is that this commitment be perfectly binding in the sense that Alice, once she sent this commitment message, there is no other value of A which she can reveal no matter how much time she has at her disposal. Okay, that the value of A is uniquely determined by the first message. And conversely, what we'd like from Bob is that given this commitment, it's computationally difficult for Bob to figure out anything about A, say to distinguish it from a commitment of zero. And a protocol that satisfies this is if I've got a one-way permutation, let's say, so a function that's easy to evaluate in one direction but not in the other, Alice might send a random string X, pick a random string Y, and evaluate the permutation on it, and then send so she'll use the inner product of X and Y to generate a bit and use it to mask her secret A. Okay, so this is this is an example of a commitment protocol. So here X and Y are chosen independently and at random. And then to open, Alice just has to send Y. And the point is, if this permutation is hard to invert on average, then this commitment is computationally indistinguishable from a commitment of zero from Bob's point of view. And that's a result in the classical case of Goldreich and Levin. And it was refined in the quantum case by Adcock and Cleave recently. Okay, so that's one tool we need. And the other tool we need is the idea of secret sharing, which we've come up many times, has come up many times before. If Alice has a secret which she'd like to share with Bob, she can break it into two pieces, sort of A and B, which add to her secret. And in the case of malicious adversaries, maybe I shouldn't have emphasized, I didn't emphasize this enough, we want the security conditions to hold no matter what Bob's behavior is. Okay. And in the case of malicious adversaries, maybe a natural notion of sharing information is that Alice will, or let's say Alice and Bob receive shares X and Y, so there are two numbers, X and Y, that add to some secret A. Alice gets one piece, Bob gets the other, and somehow each of them is committed to X. Well, each of them is committed to his piece. So if Alice is committed to X and Bob is committed to Y, then not only is the information shared, but it's shared in some kind of verifiable way. Neither of them can reveal anything except the correct answer. Okay, so these are fundamental concepts in the classical sort of tools that have been developed in the classical world for designing protocols, and they'll be important here too. All right, so as I said, what we want is a kind of a protocol schema that I want to tell you how to commit and share quantum inputs in a way that seems reasonably secure, then how to operate on these committed states, and then finally how to distribute them. So the quantum tool I'll need is something called an authentication scheme, which is a lot like a private key version of a commitment. So so let's say what I'd like to, what I'll, the get, yeah, how, let's say. What I'd like is a protocol which, as Daniel said in his previous talk, behaves like this. It behaves like a black box, such that if I've got some adversary, Eve, who wants to modify a message sent from Alice to Bob, okay, and actually a more representative in this context setting is where Alice wants to send a message to herself at some later point in time. So Alice will input some quantum state rho, and Eve gets to tamper arbitrarily with the channel, okay. And so what Alice will, I'm sorry, so what, let me restart that again. The kind of ideal behavior we want, Alice inputs a quantum state rho. Eve gets to, all Eve gets to do is input one bit, which is either let it go through or don't. And then what comes out at the other end is either rho or some special symbol indicating that the data was erased. Okay. And the idea is that this is possible under the assumption that Alice shares with herself a classical key. Okay, which she basically uses to encrypt and authenticate the data. And we'll denote this step in this way. So I'll just draw a pink box and put rho inside it, and the key is a subscript. Okay. All right, so what's the basic idea of the protocol? Again, we've got our two parties, Alice and Bob. And now, the first stage, as I said, is for Alice to commit to her input. And so what she can do is she'll pick a random key K and authenticate rho with respect to K. And then what she'll do is she'll commit to K in to this classical string K using a classical commitment. And I'll just use a white box for that. Okay, so she takes her input row A, she picks a K Alice, and what she'll do is she'll send the authenticated state to Bob and then commit to the classical key. Okay, and the idea is that at this point Alice is committed to this quantum state, because the most she can do in terms of opening things for from Bob's point of view, the most she can do is basically reveal this key to Bob. And then Bob can obtain the state. But she can't really change it in any way. Conversely, Bob can't really because he doesn't know the key, he can't tamper with this state. And so at any point, Alice could ask for it back, and he would have to hand it back unchanged if he doesn't want to get caught. So the first phase of the protocol is that each player authenticates their respective inputs this way. And now, to borrow a phrase, they are, fortunately, neither of them can change the state that it's been committed to, but unfortunately they can't do anything else with it. So what we'd like to do is sort of reduce, just as in Daniel's talk, we need to be able to compute with this data, and this is where things get tricky. but the authentication schemes that were published in the original paper on authenticating quantum data, they have a few nice additional properties. Okay, so the nice additional properties are that first of all, is that we can do Clifford operations on the authenticated data if we modify the keys appropriately. Okay, so roughly speaking, so for example, I think a generating set for Clifford operations is C0, Hadamard, maybe I need a poly gate in there too, I'm not sure, I forget. This should do it. But, so what I need is, so as an example, if I take a Hadamard tensor at n times with itself and apply it on an authenticated state rho, then I guess what I can say is for every k, I can compute some k prime such that these quantum states are equal. Okay, so that I can by essentially doing a, in this case, a Hadamard operation on each of the bits of the authenticated system, it's roughly the same as performing a Hadamard operation on the logical state and also changing the key. And these computations are easy to do. Given K, it's relatively straightforward to compute K prime for all the Clifford operations. And the other property we'll use is that I can basically perform Pauli operations on the encrypted data without even doing anything. Okay, so I can, for Pauli operations, let's say I've got some Pauli operator sigma, then given K, there exists a K prime, which is easy to compute, such that the same kind of thing holds but no operation is necessary. So what that means, if we look at what's going on over here, is that Alice can perform, for example, or Alice could perform Pauli operations on her committed state if she could change this key. Okay, so those are the two kind of, let's say, weakly homomorphic properties we need from this from these authentication schemes. And that'll pretty much be good enough to get us moving. Okay. So the first idea is that the first thing that Alice and Bob need to do is they need to move their states so they're authenticated with the same key. I'm cheating a bit. There are actually two parts of the key. One of them is going to be the same. One of them is going to be different. But at this level of abstraction, it's good enough. So what we'll do is we'll run. This is where I want to use the fact that we can do two-party computations, essentially arbitrary ones. Alice and Bob will run a two-party computation to compute some new random key K. And now what Alice will get to learn is a transformation that maps states encoded with K prime into states encoded with K. And Bob will be able to learn a transformation that maps states encoded with KA. Bob gets to learn a transformation that takes states encoded with KB, maps them into the corresponding state incorporated with K. Okay, so this is the first thing, and then each of them does this operation so that now Alice has Bob state encoded with K, and similarly Bob for Bob. And the point is now that these things are that these keys somehow correspond in the right way, that Clifford operations involving more than one qubit will be able to be done on the pair. And so what Alice will do is she'll take this, she'll send it over to Bob. And what this one of the outcomes of this classical computation will be a committed version of K. Okay, so K is now committed and shared between Alice and Bob. Okay. The last thing I wanted to say, now that Bob has all the states encoded with respect to the same key, he can do, with the help of classical computation on the keys, he can do arbitrary Clifford operations. So they're going to run a protocol to do the computations on keys. And the protocol will give Bob instructions sometimes on what sequence of operations he needs to do. But basically, what this will allow them to do is to do arbitrary Clifford operations on their jointly encoded state. In order to use this properly, we need. We're stuck in the situation where we can do Clifford operations, but not necessarily everything. And there's a There's a result that was mentioned by Daniel, but which I'll mention again for sort of self-containment, which is that given if I'm given Clifford operations, if I'm given on one hand Clifford operations which I can perform exactly, and on the other hand an untrusted source of Toffoli states, okay, so these are states that look like this, we're not actually working with bits in the protocol, but it's not too important. So given these tools, we can approximate any quantum circuit U to exponentially small fidelity. I mean, exponentially close to one, that is. Okay, so the fact that you can work with Clifford operations and a source of good Toffoli states certainly dates back to at least as far as Shor's original paper on fault tolerance, so 95 or something. The fact that you can work with an untrusted Toffoli state and get exponentially good fidelity essentially comes out of the Fox paper that Daniel presented this morning, but essentially it involves using existing tools on fault tolerant computation. Okay, the pieces of this I don't know, lemma, fact, whatever it is, are certainly well known and around, though maybe getting the exact statement isn't entirely trivial. So why is this a useful fact? Because now what it means is that Bob can input on his own, he can input untrusted Toffoli states into the computation, and then using the same kind of commitment protocol, and then using the help of these joint computations that they do together on the classical authentication keys, Bob can perform, it can run the circuit U to an arbitrary accuracy. Okay. So at the end of this phase, what basically happens is Bob gets the output, rho prime AB, encrypted with this key K, and then he'll take one of these pieces, the A piece, and send it back to Alice, and at the very end, they will open this key K. Okay. So it's not quite visible, but at the very end, they each learn K. Okay. So this is the basic outline of the protocol, and what I'd like to convince you is that we can actually prove security in this sense of a simulation I spoke about earlier. Okay. So suppose now we have a slightly different picture. We have a picture. We have our cheating Bob here. We have our trusted U here, and Alice's state is only ever seen by this trusted box. Okay, and now sitting around Bob, we have a simulator who's going to try and convince Bob that he's interacting with this trusted state. And what we'll need is that the simulator be able to, in addition to playing Alice's role, the simulator will need to be able to affect the the simulator will need to be able to influence the classical computation somewhat, and I'll try to highlight that, well, now. Okay, so we've got this Bob is just a circuit or a sequence of circuits with some additional input. And now what we'd like to do is to kind of convince Bob that he's playing he's in this protocol, and yet somehow without having access. So the simulator, simulator's problem is he doesn't have access to Alice's state. So in that sense, he has to kind of fake Alice's input. So the way it works basically is that what the simulator will do is first he generates some entangled state. So let's say RA SA. So this is a state on two systems, which is actually some fully entangled state, like say a singlet state or something, but in many copies. And similarly, he'll generate one for Bob. So these indices, subscripts are A. And what the simulator will do is first, when the simulator needs to provide Alice's input, he will just input halves of EPR pairs. Okay? And then the rest of this stuff he'll do honestly. And then when Bob will send him back Bob will send the state. Okay. I guess what I should have mentioned, I didn't want to draw it, but I did want to say it. In this protocol, there are additional steps where we verify that authentication, that states are correctly authenticated. So it's not sufficient to have Bob's promise that things have been well authenticated. I actually have to make him prove it to me somehow. And that, turns out, is not too much of a problem. Okay. So what does the simulator do now? The simulator will now somehow influence the classical computation. So the yellow is for this now crooked classical computation controlled by the simulator, and the crooked classical computation will tell the simulator Bob's key. Okay, so Bob, we're going to need to tailor the classical computation so that it's possible for the simulator to do this. Now, given Bob's key, what the simulator can do is it can just decode. Okay, and now basically send row B to this trusted box. Okay, so row B, we don't know what row B is. It's chosen by Bob. Bob is behaving arbitrarily, can behave arbitrarily badly. But whatever it is, because of basically protocols that verified that things were authenticated correctly, there's some state that's in there, and that's what gets sent to this U. Okay, and then we get back some output. So the next thing is to, well, before the output comes back, so I decode row B, and what I replace it with is, again, half of EPR pairs, halves of EPR pairs. Okay, so given that I know the key, that's easy. And now at this point, we just do everything honestly. Okay. And because Bob all the time is computing with these with these authenticated states, he doesn't really know what it is he's manipulating, and so there's no way for him to tell the difference between there's no way for him to tell the difference between the simulation and the real protocol. Then at the very end, what we end up with, the kind of global state is some U applied to halves of EPR pairs here. And the other halves of the R pair is here. Okay, and so what, and these are, and so what Alice will do is just apply, not Alice, but the simulator will apply U inverse basically to these singlet halves, and the resulting state will be, will have the effect of returning these entangled pairs to their original state. Okay, so what Alice can do after they've worked, you know, for whatever it is, k cubed rounds or something to do all these computations, at the very end, the simulator just undoes it in one move. Okay? And can do this by virtue of having substituted in EPR pairs for which she holds the corresponding halves. And now, the simulator is almost done. So now the simulator is given back row B prime and somehow has to hand this output to Bob, this output row B prime to Bob, but Bob, of course, never hands back his authenticated outputs. But that's okay. So what Alice will do is she'll once again cause the influence this supposedly secure classical computation. So what she'll do is she'll take row B and these EPR half pairs, feed them through a teleportation circuit, and get out some Pauli operator, P, let's say. And now what? Remember what we said, that we have this this property that for every, I guess I called it sigma there, it's not too important. For every Pauli operator, I can modify an authentication key to essentially cause that Pauli operator to be applied to the authenticated data. So now, in the last phase, when this classical computation would normally send K to Bob, or some K prime or something, I guess, let's call it K, what Alice will do is actually send, what she'll cause it to send the K prime corresponding to this Pauli operator, and what Bob will recover when these states go into the decoder, Bob will essentially unwittingly teleport the output from the trusted party into his own hands. So this is how the simulator looks. And the first claim I'd like to make, which I won't prove rigorously, is just that subject to appropriate manipulation of these classical computations, this run of the simulator, from Bob's point of view, is indistinguishable from the real protocol and gives, you know, in particular gives him the same output, but it's a stronger statement that he just can't tell them apart. Okay. So that's what the protocol looks like, and now the question is, how can we fiddle with these classical computations so that they can be manipulated in this way by a simulator, even despite the fact that Bob is a quantum adversary? And I won't, unfortunately, have time to explain it in detail, but I'll try to give you a very high-level summary of what's going on. The main piece, the important piece of these computations are what are called zero-knowledge proofs. So we've got a prover and a verifier, and they share some formula phi, and maybe the prover, if he's honest, has an input x such that a witness w such that the formula evaluated on the witness is 1. Okay, so it's a witness to the satisfiability of the formula, and they want to run some protocol and normally it has, let's say I'll give the 30-second version of John's talk. The protocol should have two properties. So on one hand, if the prover is honest, I'm sorry, if the verifier is honest, then the prover passes only if phi is actually satisfiable. Okay. And secondly, is if the verifier is dishonest, or for any verifier, there exists a simulator which, given only phi, can produce a faithful simulation of the verifier's view. So what this means is that the verifier, traditional interpretation of the statement is that the verifier learns nothing except the veracity of the statement being claimed, and the statement is just that this formula phi is satisfiable. So what John Watchers gave a very nice argument. He gave a specific protocol for which these properties hold even when the verifier can be maliciously behaving quantum circuit. Okay, so the problem comes from the fact that we would like, the problem comes not from condition 2, problem comes from condition 1. In order to be able to fake things properly, the simulator has to be able to learn the value of this k, okay, which in the context of the zero knowledge proof means that what we'd actually want is that for all provers there exists a simulator which simulates the view, okay, on one hand, and also learns the witness. Okay? So a simulator who not only produces a faithful simulation of the prover's view of the protocol, but also in the case that the protocol accepts, in case when the prover passes the verifier's test, the simulator should also output a witness to the veracity of the statement. And that's where things get complicated, because classically the normal tricks that one uses to prove this type of statement involve rewinding the simulator, and you run into the same problems as one does with similar problems as one does in proving similar problems to the ones that John Watchers solved. But these are now different, and I don't know of a simple way to get around them. So in my the last thing I want to do is present a short protocol that where one can prove these stronger properties, and I won't explain why they hold. Okay, so the rough idea is the following. Alice commits to value A, Bob says a value B. Alice, instead of opening A, she just says what A is, and they engage in a proof where Alice proves to Bob that A is the correct value. Okay. And so this is a coin flipping protocol. They'll now use the value A plus B as a set of random coins. And specifically, Bob will now will view this set of random coins as a public key for some public key encryption scheme. Bob will use the public key to encrypt. So sorry, this is now my prover and my verifier. The prover will use the public key to encrypt the witness W, and then engage in the usual proof of set ZK, another zero knowledge proof that phi of W is actually equal to 1. Okay. And the short version is that in this new protocol, the simulator playing the role of the verifier can control the value of A, and can thus control the value of the public key, can choose it so that he has so it has a known secret key, and can then decrypt the witness and learn what the, and if the prover has a reasonable chance of passing this protocol, then the verifier will actually learn the witness. Okay, so that's I guess what I wanted to say about this. I'm sort of out of time, but the high level point I suppose I wanted to wind up with is that there have been a lot of techniques that have been developed for proving security in the classical literature, and these techniques need not always apply. And it's an interesting question to try and understand what range of tools we can use in the quantum setting to prove security of protocols and to establish sort of general results, both general results along the lines of what was done in the 80s in classical crypto, and also come up with more efficient protocols of various kinds. Okay, so I'm sorry for going over time. Thanks. Yeah, well, so view it as a unitary transformation applied to some ancilla and then maybe throwing some stuff away, and then the answer is yes. Yeah, I mean, so the restriction to unitaries was essentially without loss of generality. I just wanted to have simpler notation. Okay, so there are two statements. So one, on the one hand, what it gives us, which I think is new, is a classical two-party computing a protocol for securely evaluating any classical circuit, which is secure even against quantum adversaries. Okay, so that's the first statement. And the second statement is, moreover, this is one can strengthen this to get a protocol for securely evaluating quantum circuits on quantum data. And I guess the way to encapsulate it is to say, you know, all the difficulties that Watrous was wrestling with in his paper sort of arise here also, and we kind of deal with them by essentially reducing the problem to maybe what I didn't say, so I basically reduced it to John's rewinding argument, that in these protocols that the important building block is the Watcher simulator. So all these problems of auxiliary quantum information and things like that arise here too, and they can be dealt with by sort of carefully reducing the problem to the use of the Watcher simulator. Well, I mean, it's much stronger. The limitations are much stronger than that. I mean, it works for a very specific family of protocols.
Yeah, like just
from single bit challenge. Yeah. So and there's nothing different here. I mean, that the idea here is we'll construct a specific protocol, and somehow pack all the work into some statements which can be proven using, you know, three-round classical zero-knowledge proofs with one-bit challenges, and then apply use the Watcher simulator. No, well, yeah, no. I mean, I really just using the same class of zero-knowledge proofs as John. Yeah, evil.
So you assume the time is irreversible, correct?
Not exactly, actually. Well, time is irreversible. I mean, I guess. I mean, if I knew a way around that, I would have finished sooner. But there is rewinding going on in the protocol. I'm not sure if that's what you were asking, though.
Well,
In the simulation, sorry, there is rewinding going on, but.